Most likely, the first time you walked into this sanctuary, your immediate thought was not Marie Antoinette. But it might have been, because there is a real, though indirect, connection between the late 18th century European revolutions and Tiffany windows. You may know the story of Tiffany, but I did not. So this sermon for me has been a fascinating glimpse into a small piece of America's art history. What I offer this morning is a novice's perspective on the life and background of the artist, Lewis Comfort Tiffany, and Marianne will offer a historian's perspective on the church's seven glorious windows. But back to Marie Antoinette. Lewis Comfort Tiffany of the Tiffany Windows had the very good fortune of being born into the Tiffany family. His father, Charles Lewis Tiffany, had opened a small stationery store in 1837 in New York City with money, $1,000, that his father had given him as a loan. By the way, 1837 is, of course, the year that Theodore Parker was called as the new minister of this church. Charles Tiffany soon began both making and selling jewelry as well as selling stationery, and he had a partner who traveled to Europe, where he found jewels from disposed royal families and brought them back. And it seems that it was actually acquiring the French crown jewels in 1887 that established Tiffany and Company as America's premier jewelers. His son, Lewis Comfort Tiffany, like so many offspring, did not want to follow in his father's footsteps and had little interest in joining the family business. He planned instead to devote himself to the fine arts, which is exactly what he did. There isn't much, or I didn't find much, available about his early years other than accounts that he was headstrong in personality and that he didn't like school or schoolwork either. Initially, he wanted to be an artist, a painter, and he left school at age 17 to do that, to travel and study painting. And it was on his first trip to England when he was just 18 in 1865 that he first saw a collection of Roman and Syrian glass at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. That collection made a deep impression on him, and today the Victoria and Albert has its own collection of Tiffany glass. He returned home to study at the National Academy of Design with landscape painter George Innes and then moved to Paris, where he was particularly impressed by the colors that he saw on his travels in Spain, Morocco, Tunisia, and Algeria. His contemporary artists and friends included John Singer Sargent, Whistler, St. Gaudens, and with them he founded the Society of American Artists. But it wasn't too long after that that he decided there were too many good artists, too many artists better than he was, and he concluded he would make his mark in a different medium. Yet it really was those early years as a painter that had given him such an appreciation for both color and especially color in nature. So now he would work in decorative arts. His philosophy was to create beautiful environments for everyday living. And he was not shy. He was not shy at all about wanting to make a lot of money from his art, which he did. Again, it was his good fortune that the Industrial Revolution and the Gilded Age enabled many who were reaping the benefits of unrestrained capitalism to buy Tiffany wallpaper, Tiffany textiles, Tiffany furniture, Tiffany lampshades, and Tiffany glass. By the mid-1880s, Tiffany was working almost exclusively in glass, His goal was to create a new kind of stained glass window, similar to the windows that he had seen in the European cathedrals built in the Middle Ages. And he was determined not to paint to get the vibrant colors that he wanted, because he felt that painting glass obscured the glass's natural transparency. He wanted the glass itself to transmit the color. This desire led him to build his own glass furnaces and, of course, the Tiffany Glass Company, enabling him to develop a new kind of glass called Faville, which is French for by hand, perhaps his greatest innovation. And by the 1880s, the Tiffany Glass Company was the leading producer of stained glass windows in the United States. He wanted to be the most fashionable purveyor of taste, and he was prolific in his work. He created windows for private homes and institutions, hotels, clubs, universities, libraries, hospitals, and, of course, churches. He actually had an ecclesiastical department in his company for commissions from churches and synagogues. Promoting his work at the World's Fairs in Philadelphia and Paris, his masterpiece, a Romanesque chapel, was the highlight of the 1893 exposition in Chicago. And here I quote Marianne when she writes, "A number of windows in the chapel featured Tiffany's opalescent glass, including the model for what would become the Theodore Parker Memorial Window, which is the window behind the pulpit, the window of the angel." His time of peak production of stained glass windows and lampshades was between 1900 and 1914. According to biographers, Tiffany was preoccupied with perfection. And while he was both a generous and fair employer, he could also veer on the side of tyranny as he walked through the studio with his cane and would smash on the spot any work he didn't think was up to his standards. He is also known for staffing his production department with women, which was unusual for the day, to say the least. And Clara Driscoll, his top designer, was thought to have earned one of the largest salaries of any employee of the day. In fact, another designer, Agnes Northrup, was the designer for the landscape genre, as we see in the beautiful window triptych. Tiffany was married twice. Both wives predeceased him, and he had 8 children, 2 of whom died very young. In 1902, he bought 600 acres of land overlooking the Long Island Sound, where he spent the next 2 years building his own family mansion of 85 rooms called Laurelton Hall, and that was to be his summer house. Tiffany's career peaked in the years before World War I, and his story, alas, does not have a happy ending. Because after the war, tastes began to change, as tastes do, and wealthy patrons lost interest in his brilliant colors. They wanted something more subdued. It's hard to believe that his studio declared bankruptcy in 1932, and he died the following year in 1933, thinking that his work no longer wanted would be forgotten. The books I read said that a revival of interest in his work began in the 1950s and that today it's at an all-time high. Alistair Duncan writes, quote, "Tiffany left an incomparable legacy, unique in its unapologetic orgy of colors and its worship of nature." In a speech he gave in 1916, Tiffany said of his work, "If I may be forgiven a word about my own work, I would merely say that I have always striven to fix beauty in wood or stone or glass or pottery and oil or watercolor by using whatever seemed fittest to the expression of beauty. That has been my creed, and I see no reason to change it." And this morning, we honor that beauty.
In addition to honoring Tiffany this morning, we are also honoring those who brought the beauty of his windows into our sanctuary and into our lives. All of our windows, and most of Tiffany's ecclesiastical windows, are memorial windows. They honor longtime congregants and our minister, who, through gifts given to us by their family members, continue to bless us. And for me, the windows help create sacred space. The first window I'll talk about is the memorial window for Theodore Parker, minister from 1837 to 46, which of course we all know. Church records indicate that the plan was always to install it in the most prominent place in the sanctuary, right behind the pulpit. It was initially in the parish hall when that was the sanctuary, and then it was moved here in 1900 when this sanctuary was dedicated. According to the chair of the parish hall building committee, much thought was given to getting a really good design for the 6-foot diameter window. Unlike other Tiffany windows, this window was funded by the congregation. It took them 2 years to raise the funds for the figure who, according to Tiffany records, symbolizes the bearer of good tidings of the herald of the dawn. And perhaps this was the congregation's view of Theodore Parker. The other 6 Tiffany windows were given by individual church families to honor family members. So who were these people, and what was the age that they lived in? The last third of the 19th century was the greatest period of economic growth in American history. It was the age of business, tycoons, the Gilded Age, and tremendous urban growth. Between 1870 and 1900, Boston's population more than doubled, from 250,000 to 560,000 people. West Roxbury, formally incorporated into Boston in 1874, became a residential commuter community with houses clustered along the train route. The family farms, originally settled by Puritans, were either bought by very successful entrepreneurs and then turned into estates, or were subdivided into relatively large homes for businessmen who then commuted into the city on the train. Most of those honored in the windows had moved to West Roxbury after the train line was established. Typically, the husbands were successful merchants whose careers spanned the 1870s to the early 1900s. Most of them were also from families with deep Puritan roots, having settled in Massachusetts in the 1630s. They were also long-standing, active members of this congregation, often attending for 30 or 40 years. By far, the wealthiest of these was Jason Samuel Bailey, who gave us the landscape triptych, the one that we all look at when we're really supposed to be up here looking at the minister. So, the 3-panel window was designed specifically for this space by Agnes Northrup, the creator of the landscape genre for Tiffany Studios. And Jason Samuel Bailey was born in Pomfret, Vermont. Charlie and Carol will know Pomfret Street. Northrup often used photographs of the mountains and scenery at a patron's desired location to create her glorious windows, so the mountains in this window may be those of Vermont. Bailey was known in Boston as the originator of the 5 and dime stores — Woolworth was operating in Indiana at the time — and of the 6-story department store, a new concept in retail merchandising. The Boston department store was so successful that he opened other large department stores in Springfield, Worcester, and Brooklyn. In each venture, he owned the real estate as well. With his various real estate holdings, he was one of the 3 largest taxpayers in Boston. He was also a cotton broker and raised cotton from seed in his greenhouses that he proudly displayed in his office, calling them Massachusetts cotton. His multi-acre estate, built at 200 Corey Street in West Roxbury in 1878, contained a shingle-style mansion, conservatory, greenhouses, and extensive lily pods. He was a larger-than-life persona, and very generous. When the earlier white clapboard church burned in 1890, he put up the badly needed matching funds for a new sanctuary that is now our parish hall. And in 1910, Bailey announced that he would set aside the funds for the triptych. And although we have no record of what the Bailey family paid for this triptych, it would have been his style to spare no expense. We are very fortunate today to have the great grand niece of Jason Samuel Bailey with us. Her grandfather was one of Bailey's nephews. Sandra Lagey lives in South Weymouth, and she found us on the internet after we had these windows restored. Sandra. Okay, let's now turn to the two jewel medallion windows flanking the triptych. The windows represent Tiffany's homage to the stained glass windows of 13th century Gothic churches. The windows are distinguished by sparkling pieces of rough-cut glass resembling precious and semi-precious stones. The window near the piano right here is called the Ministry of Music. It's filled with singing angels and humans. The window was installed in 1921 in memory of Washington and Harriet Snelling by their daughter Emma. Washington Snelling was born in East Boston in 1831. His father was in the booming ship business as a ship chandler, specializing in supplying and repairing ships. He was also a city councilor from East Boston for several years. The son, Washington Snelling, was a very successful hardware dealer, also in East Boston. He and Harriet Fole married in 1854 and had six children. And sometime after 1880, they moved to Mount Vernon Street, just a few blocks from the church. They were faithful churchgoers for more than 30 years until their deaths in 1916 and 1917. Their daughter, Emma, who gave the window in their memory, would have spent her late teens and early 20s here before she married George Ferran, an MIT engineering graduate, and they moved to New York City. We don't know why she chose the Ministry of Music design, but for at least 5 years in the early to mid-1890s, Emma's younger sister, Charlotte, was our choir director. And now, looking at the parables of Jesus, the window at the far corner on the other side of the triptych depicts the parables of the sower, the Good Samaritan, and the prodigal son. It was given in memory of Charles Dorn and Ellen Josephine Dorn by their children. Ah, C.J. Dorn. Now, that name also appears in this morning's leaflet. Yes. Charles Dorn was a noted guitarist, composer, and teacher. Born in Boston in 1839, he returned to Europe with his German-born parents when he was 14 to study guitar with his uncle, James Dorn, a well-known horn player, guitarist, and court musician. Upon his return to the U.S., Dorn became one of America's foremost guitarists, frequently touring the country. He published over 50 works for guitar, including the two pieces that Marcia played this morning. Longtime parishioners of the church, Charles Dorn and his wife Ellen lived in West Roxbury for more than 30 years before his death in 1909, and she passed away in 1931. As far as I've been able to find out, the Dorns were not wealthy people. They rented their house. Their children, Frederick and Elizabeth, lived with their mother well into their middle age. Frederick worked in a hardware store, and Elizabeth was an elementary school teacher in West Roxbury. When we describe our church to others, we often note that we are a musical congregation. Yukiko, our concert pianist, Michael Johnson, our fabulous choir director, the TP singers, many in the congregation who also play instruments, belong to other choral groups, or just enjoy music. What I didn't know until I researched the windows is that we have a very long musical lineage in this church, going back at least 150 years. The seventh and last Tiffany window is actually the oldest, installed in the parish hall in 1893, where it still resides just inside the doorway from the breezeway. It depicts a child angel dropping petals onto the lap of a sleeping woman and features drapery glass, one of Tiffany's stunning innovations that you can see in the woman's bodice and in her skirt. The window was given to the church by Samuel and Catherine Dana in memory of their son and his mother. His mother was a Weld, Sarah Weld Billings. The Weld family was one of the original Roxbury settlers in the 1630s, and it was Joseph Weld who donated the land for our original church in 1712. Like Jason Bailey, Samuel Dana was among the wealthy merchant class. He was a very successful cotton broker in Boston and owned his old brokerage firm. And cotton was the largest U.S. export until well into the 20th century. The Danas lived in a substantial Georgia colonial house on the corner of Center and LaGrange Streets in West Roxbury, and they had been active churchgoers for over 15 years when they donated the window in the new church. For years, these windows have grounded me in a spiritual place without my knowing who they honored or who had given the windows. They didn't have to give these gifts to us, but they chose to. And for that, I am very grateful.